Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of October. Happy to have Michael Pollan with us this hour, who we've interviewed several times. He's written, and perhaps many of you saw this, in the New York Times Magazine section on Sunday, a letter to Farmer-in-Chief, what the next president can and should do to remake the way we grow and eat our food. He starts the article, "Dear Mr. President-elect, it may surprise you to learn that among the issues that will occupy much of your time in the coming years is one you barely mentioned during the campaign. Food. Food policy is not something American presidents have had to give much thought to, at least since the Nixon administration, the last time high food prices presented a serious political peril." The article goes on to look at the rise in fast food, where we get our calories, how farmers have planted according to fast food needs, why it is we need to go into a different kind of farming, and the government needs to support many, many more farmers in this country, how it is we should be teaching our children about food, and what example the first family can set when it comes to eating at the dining room table in the White House. He also goes so far as to say maybe we need gardens on the White House lawns, get rid of some of that gorgeous grass and plant terrific farms. Wouldn't that be a symbol of eating healthful foods? Well, Michael is with us this hour. And he is a Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of several books, including In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. And his article that I was mentioning and reading from appears in the October 12 issue of the New York Times Magazine. Well, welcome phone calls for him. We get tons of calls on this topic, and it's such an interesting article. 800-486-8655 is the number, or feel free to send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Hello again, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, Kathleen. Good to be back on the show.
Isn't it interesting that here's an issue that is so huge, and yet you're right, it's hardly mentioned on the campaign trail, the subject of food.
Yeah, well, you know, there's some other stuff in the news, I think, is part of it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I don't think either candidate is highly sensitized to the issue and how it connects to the issues they do care about. You know, from reading their websites. And part of the problem is it's very hard to have a national political conversation about food policy because of the way we structure our primary season. I mean, basically, you know, all candidates have to pass through Iowa to get elected president. Mm-hmm. And when they're in Iowa, they have to say certain things to get out alive. One is that they support the current farm bill, more or less, and the whole setup of crop subsidies that we have, and that they support ethanol. And right there, you've got, you know, you've kind of checkmated on really examining the whole food system and what needs to be done. So, but I do think that they are going to discover when they get, whoever it is, when he gets into office, that if he hopes to make progress on the issues he did campaign on, such as energy independence, climate change, and the healthcare crisis, and those have been three issues that have been quite prominent, they will discover, much to their surprise, I think, that you cannot make significant progress on any of those three issues without dealing with the food system.
Isn't that something? Those are huge issues, Michael.
Well, food shadows all of them. I mean, if you consider that 19% of the fossil fuel we burn is to feed ourselves, the way we feed ourselves. It's a very fossil fuel intense system. So you're not going to really get a hold on your oil consumption unless you look at how much oil is in our food system. And we can talk about why that is. And then on climate change, it turns out that the food system is responsible for between a fifth and a third, depending on the estimate you use, of the greenhouse gases that are produced.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to make significant progress on that issue unless you figure out a way to reduce the carbon imprint of the food system. And then on health care, both candidates agree that you've got to get health care costs down. They've gone up dramatically in the last couple decades. But if you look at what's driven the increase, I mean, there's several reasons, but a big one is the cost to the healthcare system of diet-related chronic diseases. The top four or five killers are diet-related chronic diseases, and it accounts for more than $250 billion a year in healthcare spending. I'm talking about obesity and diabetes and heart disease and other cardiovascular diseases. You're not going to get a handle on healthcare costs unless you deal with the catastrophe of the American diet.
Right. And that's only bound to get worse when you look at the number of children. And I'm so glad there are so many components to your article and to your plan for food. But one of the components is to look at schools, right, and what we're feeding young people and changing all of that, because they're getting sick early on.
You know, the current projections from the Center for Disease Control is that 1 in 3 children born in the year 2000 will suffer from type 2 diabetes.
Goodness.
We know this, and yet you go into the schools and you will find that they're feeding our kids chicken nuggets and tater tots. And they're feeding them junk food. They're training them to eat junk food. You know, so one hand of the government is concerned about type 2 diabetes, while the other hand is helping to cause it.
Right. You say in the article, and let's get a little history here before setting out your agenda for reforming the food system, it is important to understand how that system came to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, the food system, I mean, I'm very critical of industrial agriculture, but I think it's important to acknowledge what it has accomplished, and that is that it has made food for Americans very cheap. We spend less of our income on food than anyone on Earth, than anyone in the history of civilization. You know, when you think about it, the fact that you can walk into a fast food restaurant and buy, a double cheeseburger, large fries, large soda for less than what you would earn at the minimum wage in an hour is an amazing achievement. In the course of human history, we have not been able to put that much food on tables that cheaply. On the other hand, the way we've done it, it has come at a very steep price. We've done it by basically creating an agriculture based on a very small number of crops, corn and soy being high among them, that we then process. And we can grow these crops in incredible abundance because of the really the genius of industrial agriculture. These vast monocultures that are dependent on fossil fuel fertilizers, fossil fuel pesticides, lots of transportation of food, lots of processing of food. And we've learned how to take that cheap raw material, or formerly cheap raw material, the price has spiked in the last year, and turn it into very cheap feedlot meat and incredibly cheap sweeteners in the form of high fructose corn syrup and very cheap fat in the form of hydrogenated soy oil. I mean, these are the building blocks of fast food, and we know how to grow them really well. But, you know, the problem is that system is not sustainable without cheap energy. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen food prices spike this year, that energy is no longer cheap, mm-hmm. and therefore food is no longer cheap. So what it tells you is that, yes, with lots of cheap energy, we could put lots of cheap food on the table. But now that the cheap energy is that those days are over, we're going to have to look at how we're growing our food and change it.
It is remarkable that energy has allowed us to get food from, I think you point, it's not happening anymore, but it probably just stopped recently, that you can grow something in California and then it gets shipped to China to get filleted, and then it gets shipped back to the United States to eat.
It
is still happening.
We catch salmon in Alaska, send it to China to get filleted, and then we eat it back in the United States. I mean, these are absurd commodity chains. But as long as you've got cheap energy, they made economic sense.
Right.
Another one that I mentioned is, we ship sugar cookies to Denmark, and we buy sugar cookies from Denmark. And as an economist once said, wouldn't it be more efficient to swap recipes?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You talk about a significant change in the way we grow crops and the kinds of crops that we grow. Can you talk about all of that, about why, you know, corn is ubiquitous and why it is that we don't rotate the planting of, one year we should be grazing and 1 year maybe vegetables, and how that is a system that we simply need to return to?
Well, you have to go back to, in the passage you read, I suggested that the last time that food prices got high, and that's really during the Nixon administration, you had a spike in food prices, much like we see today. It was caused for a different reason. We had a grain deal with Russia and sold them a lot of grain, and when it was all done in secret, so when it was announced, grain prices went through the roof. And, there were women in the streets protesting the high price of eggs and bacon, and there was horse meat showing up in butcher shops, and it was an enormous moment of political peril for the government. Governments never like high food prices. They lead to political unrest everywhere you go, and we're seeing that all over the world today. So Nixon set about figuring out a way to drive down food prices. And he did this with the help of a brilliant agriculture secretary named Earl Butz. that some of your listeners, I'm sure, remember.
Sure.
And he succeeded, basically. He convinced a great many farmers to, as he said, get bigger, get out, plow fence row to fence row, you know, concentrate on one or two crops. He started, he changed the subsidy system so farmers were paid by the bushel. Instead of having crop supports to hold up prices, he did things to basically drive down prices. And it all worked. And the reason it worked, though, is by the reason you could have farmers moving to these less diversified monocultures of corn and soy was that we had cheap fossil fuel. Because you need that. You cannot have a big monoculture without the fertilizer to replenish the soil, because if you keep growing corn or even just corn and soy, you deplete the nitrogen in the soil. And you can't have a big monoculture without pesticides, because pests love big fields of lots of the same thing. It means lots of food for them. So you need lots of pesticides, and those are made from petroleum. So really, you know, this replacement of human energy with fossil fuel energy in our agriculture, because you can't, of course, one farmer, you know, without those technologies cannot farm a huge farm. And the other part of this policy is, of course, we've been driving farmers off the land for most of the last century. We have wanted more workers in the factories in the cities, and so we discourage people from staying on the land, and therefore the farms got bigger. So fossil fuel revolutionized our agriculture, and it, you know, as I say, it worked in one sense. It made food cheap. It meant that right now a single American farmer in the Middle West can feed 140 Americans. That, in the course of human history, is an amazing achievement. These are the most productive individuals that have ever lived. On the other hand, what allows them to be so productive is that we have replaced human labor with fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from the fertilizers, the pesticides, the diesel equipment on the farm. It's amazing what one farmer can do today.
Yeah, and we need more farmers. That's another part of your plan.
Well, that's
too.
The hard part. That's the really hard part of returning to. And I shouldn't use the word return, because I'm not talking about going back. I mean, I think we need to go forward, and a lot of the proposals I'm suggesting, while they may be based on elements of traditional agriculture, are things we really haven't seen in this country. But the fact is, to grow food without cheap energy is going to take a lot more hands on the land. And we are going to need tens of millions of people, whether they're growing food in their gardens or they're becoming farmers. And we have to make it easier for people to become farmers. We have to raise the prestige of farming. Because I think we've denigrated farming for far too long in this country. But farmers of the future, these are going to be the new green jobs that, you know, that the candidates talk about that we need. Sophisticated polyculture farms.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk that maybe we all need to become farmers in a way. How about returning to Victory Gardens, which was an interesting thought, and putting a larger Victory Garden next to the White House?
Yeah, well,
there you go.
You know, one of my proposals in this piece is, you know, there's certain things the president can do on his own without, you know, passing through the Agriculture Committee and committees in the House and Senate. And one is he can rip out 5 acres of that White House lawn, beautiful as it is, and put in a vegetable garden. It happened once before. Eleanor Roosevelt did it in 1941. She put in a Victory Garden to help with the war effort. Over, I should point out, the objections of the USDA, who was afraid that it would hurt the food industry. But by the end of World War II, there were 20 million Victory Gardens. These are people who just ripped up their lawn and grew some food, and they were providing 40% of the produce consumed.
I never knew that.
40%. It made a significant contribution. So if you want to reduce your carbon footprint, you know, one of the best things you can do, and this is much better than changing light bulbs, as Vice President Gore urged us to do in Inconvenient Truth, put in a garden. I mean, you will grow food. You will cut down. It won't have to be shipped. It's the shortest food chain of all. It will be fresh. It will be healthy. And by the way, you'll get exercise in the process of doing it.
Right.
So it solves a great many problems at once.
And we're looking at, as you talk about this growing, locally grown movement in this country and people ordering food from places not far away for their food for a whole year, this is a growing movement in the country.
Yeah, there's the local food movement is a very powerful force right now, and it's progressing without much help from the government. Indeed, the government's getting in its way in various ways. But there is a huge demand for local food, and farmers. There are now about 5,000 farmers markets. They're growing as fast, you know, fastest sector of the food economy. And you're seeing a very interesting re-regionalization of food. And I'm not just talking about people going to farmers markets. One of the more interesting things I learned in researching this piece, it actually didn't make it in the piece in the end, was that the price of moving a box of broccoli from the Salinas Valley, where a lot of it's grown in California, to the Hunts Point Market, which is a big distribution center in New York, went from $3 to $10.
Oh, my goodness.
In the course of a few months this year. And when that happened, one of the big growers, or a couple of the big growers in California, apparently went into the market and started buying land in New England. They recognize that in the future, they're going to need to grow their food a little closer to where it's consumed. Now, that is an old idea, you know, that New Jersey can feed New York, that each region of the country could substantially feed itself. Not everything. I mean, there's always going to be bananas and coffee and things that, you know, oranges that come from far away, and there's nothing wrong with that. But for things that can be grown everywhere, and broccoli is a pretty good example. Actually, broccoli is better in cold parts of the country. That I think we will find that the economy will lead to less produce coming from California and more of it being grown closer to home.
Michael Pollan is our guest. You may have had a chance, or after this interview, I'm sure you will, go to the New York Times this past Sunday, October 12, and there's a very, very thorough outline of what the next president needs to do to address food policy in this country, something he says that American presidents haven't given much thought to in quite a long period of time. It's such a thorough article. He talks about our era of cheap energy and how this is over right now, how to reward farmers for planting cover crops. We should make it easier for them to apply compost to their fields. He talks about how important a new food policy is in terms of our health in this country, in terms of energy, in terms of combating global climate change. So it's well worth a read and well worth a call. 800-486-8655 is our number, or email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Pollan is our guest. His piece is in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine section. He's the author of In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto, and many other books, and he's also a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to mention that Monique Jamet-Hooker, who had a restaurant in Chicago and has retired just in a house south of La Crosse, and she gives cooking lessons out of her house. She grew up in France. She's been on, I believe, Jean Ferraca's program about twice, and she came from a tradition of going out to the garden even though in November and seeing what's available and planning the meal around those products that she finds in the season. She has a cookbook out, Cooking with the Seasons, and she gives cooking classes in her own home. And she is working with the school system of Vernon County to bring more nutritious and tasty food to the school children.
Well, that's a very important set of skills we need to relearn. I mean, the fact is that we can feed ourselves locally a lot more than people think. And also, cooking is going to be a very important part of this plan because, you know, as soon as people cook, they start buying raw ingredients rather than highly processed foods. And, you know, it takes 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce every calorie of processed food. So you're suddenly, reducing your carbon footprint. You're eating better because food you cook yourself is going to be healthier. And it's a way to start building up those local food economies if people are supporting them. So one of my, I think one of the most important proposals in this little platform of mine is we have to teach people how to cook again. A lot of people don't know, and we have to begin in the schools. And so what I call for is we need to start spending a dollar more a day on every kid in public school. And that's what the experts think it'll take to move from processed fast food to fresh fresh food, we also have to require the school districts to spend a certain percentage of their procurement money buying food within 100 miles of the school. That will help build up these local food economies. And we have to teach the kids how to grow food, so we need a garden in every school, and we have to teach them how to cook it. And then we have to teach them actually how to enjoy it at a table, at a communal meal with their friends and their teachers. And one of the things I suggest is, there's so many young people who want to become cooks today, and the culinary schools are full of them, that we should have a program where we forgive their student loans in exchange for 2 years in the working as lunchroom ladies and gentlemen. If they're willing to work in the schools and help teach kids how to cook and cook for them, we should forgive their loans to culinary school.
Isn't that amazing what you just said, Michael? We don't know how to cook anymore. Isn't that quite basic?
It is incredible. But this is a critical life skill. Now, when I was in school, we had home ec, and I'm sure there are a lot of your listeners who remember home ec. But, of course, that was just for girls.
Exactly.
Boys took shop. Mm-hmm. And, we learned how to make, a Japanese lamp or something like that. And but because it was divided by gender, it fell out of favor. It was a casualty of the feminist revolution. So we need to bring it back, but it's got to be for girls and boys. We can't put this on women. I mean, cooking, and by the way, I think children today don't think about cooking as women's work. I mean, my son has no sense of that. He watches us both cook.
Sure.
He looks at, famous chefs on television, on all the cooking shows. And in fact, he's worked in the kitchen of a restaurant learning how to cook. He's very interested in it. So the point is, we could bring back something like home ec, and I think we should get a better name for it, that will, because this is a critical life skill, learning how to cook, and we're not teaching it.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Habu from Madison. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning to both of you.
Morning.
I'll suggest that there are many more things we don't know anymore than just not knowing cooking, but that's another story.
Yes. One
area that you may have covered in your article, which I haven't read, but we'll visit it, but you have not said on this program, is, the effect of the U.S. Farm Bill on peoples around the world, and the massive subsidies that make this whole situation possible here at home, but deleteriously affect people to be able to produce the cheapest cotton in the world, or in India, in Mali. This is well known. But also, there is another insidious factor in there, and that is when the price of then these countries become dependent on American grain exports moving there, and as we've recently seen, where food prices doubled, they tripled for certain grains. I mean, these people are left high and dry, and in countries where the poor spend almost 50 to 60, 70% of their little meager income on food, I mean, this means the difference between going hungry and or having just a morsel. Mm. So the third part of this is that by having these subsidies go subsidized corn and grains and foods go there, we are forcing them to just plant, cut flowers or whatever we want.
Yeah,
so literally
crops,
they become these banana republics, if you will pardon the expression.
Okay.
I'd like your comments on this, please.
Yes, well, it is an issue I address in the article, not at as great length as I'd like to, but you're absolutely right. The irony is that these cheap food policies we've had in our country, which is to stimulate overproduction through subsidies and other methods, has, while it's put lots of food on our table, it's ended up leading to hunger in the rest of the world. And here's how that works. We produce so much corn and soy and other commodities, cotton and rice, that we dump it on world markets at costs often below what it costs us to produce it. The result of that is to ruin agricultural markets in many countries. They cannot compete with this very cheap grain. So we put farmers in other countries out of business. Mexico is a great example. After NAFTA, 1.5 million Mexican corn farmers lost their farms, because we were flooding their market with our cheap subsidized corn. What happens to those farmers? Well, a lot of them ended up becoming illegal aliens and moving north. And now they work as serfs on farms in California. They'd much rather stay on their land, but they can't afford to. So, and we also forced other governments to stop supporting their farmers in the name of what was called structural adjustment and the World Bank policies, IMF policies. We said, no, you can't subsidize your fertilizer anymore. You can't subsidize your market because that's trade distorting. So we broke down a lot of barriers to our cheap food. And now that food prices have skyrocketed, these countries find themselves at the mercy of decisions made on Wall Street and in the White House, which compromise their ability to feed their population. Because take, for example, you know, the president's embrace of ethanol 2 years ago. That really lit the fire under this explosion in food prices. And suddenly, people in these other countries, because of a decision made by President Bush, found they could no longer feed their population.
Abu, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Sarah from Pell Lake next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Michael Pollan. I love you. you are, it's exactly what I've been saying. We've been trying to become locavores. I've been convincing my husband why it's a good idea to buy eggs locally and not from somewhere across the country. We're working on getting a garden. I'm working on canning the food that I buy locally.
Good for you.
And making my own jellies. But a cookbook situation, I found that a lot of the cookbooks today, because I, as being a vegetarian and with food allergies, I like to make my own food. And I found that a lot of cookbooks today have a lot of add this mix. So I started going to yard sales and antique shops, and I started buying the books from the 50s and earlier. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about that is, number one, they have these foods that you can pronounce and not add this mix with this mix. And number two, they have less food. So you have four, five, six items that are you could throw into a biscuit instead of 10 or 15 that you see in some of the newer cookbooks.
I bet the portions are smaller, too.
Cookbooks, they have that.
I bet the portions are smaller, too, in those old recipes.
Yes, yes, they are, and they're phenomenal. I couldn't believe it. And looking for a canning cookbook was insane because we've lost a lot of this knowledge.
You used to see mason jars in every hardware store, and now you really have to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes. those are all kind of life skills that I think we're going to be relearning. I mean, I think that, you know, we will be returning to a lot of the financial crisis is going to have that effect also. I mean, you know, I haven't stressed that so much, but the fact is, you know, people say, oh, it's so expensive to eat locally and go to the farmer's market. And it can be. But if you're strategic about it and do what people used to do, which is to say make several meals on a Sunday and freeze them, or, you know, figure out a way to get three meals out of a chicken, not just buying a chicken breast and you know, which is very expensive, and making one meal, you find that, you know, these old kitchen arts can stretch food. I mean, we have these, you know, peasant cooking traditions that go back hundreds of years, and there is a kind of cultural wisdom that we've lost about how to take, you know, wholesome, well-grown food and make it last.
Mm-hmm. Did you convince your husband about the eggs, Sarah?
I'm still working on it.
Oh.
I still tell him. I yell at him every time he picks it up from the grocery store. I say, we have a local store that sells them locally. Why aren't you buying them there? So, I'm still working on him yet, but I'm getting through. So.
I'm sure you are. You sound pretty convincing to me. Thanks, Sarah, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, or go to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, for you to join our conversation with Michael Pollan. And let's go to Mary from Madison next. Hi, Mary.
Oh, I'm enjoying this so much. As Wendell Berry said 30 years ago, people have never had any problem ignoring what he has to say. And I hear Wendell Berry in every word, and I love your enthusiasm, and forgive me. I think we should make a new law, since this will all fall on women as usual. No women are now going to be in home ec classes. As others have said, I'm very suspicious of a wonderful thing of which men want no part, and will fight like tigers to avoid being part of. I work with a lot of low-income women, and I just want to scream when I hear people with the best of intentions, please, I mean no respect, suggesting that they go to farmers markets and learn to cook raw food. People are trying to survive. They've got two and three jobs. I worked for several years in a state-run healthcare facility, which gave wonderful, wonderful care to patients and had exactly one place to get things to eat. And we had a soda machine and a chip and candy bar machine on every floor.
Mm-hmm.
There was a cafeteria, you had no time on your regular breaks to get over there. It was quite a long walk. And on your half-hour lunch break, by the time you got over there, got changed, got some food out, put it in the microwave, it was already time to go back. And people were simply overwhelmed with having multiple jobs, working double shifts, having young kids. And I understood quickly, despite my upper-class pretensions that I was raised with, why they were living on Mountain Dew and pizza pockets. I also live in a farming community, for better and worse. I must say not much thought went into that choice, but if I hadn't bought it, somebody else would have. And I have just been stunned at the contempt that still exists for farmers, and especially in a time when every community seems to think the dream will be people working behind a computer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As Wendell Berry said many, many years ago, we're going to be sorry someday that we've driven all these farmers away and treated them with such contempt.
Michael.
Well, that day has come. It really has. And, you know, I share your admiration for Wendell Berry, and so much of what I'm saying he said 30 years ago. I mean, we're really just picking up the threads of a conversation that he started, and Francis Moore LePay, and, you know, that group of pioneers in the 70s. It's amazing. Had we listened to them then, we would be in so much better shape in so many ways. And it's a very sad thing that message got muffled, really, during the Reagan years. But, you know, the issue of gender is very, very important, and the issue of class, too. I mean, the fact is, one of the reasons that fast food thrives is that we work so much, and women have to work so much. And so that finding the time to cook has gotten a lot harder, which is one reason it's going to have to be shared, that work must be shared by both men and women. Because women are working today. And so I think we have to start. We're not going to change people in their 40s and 50s, their attitudes about cooking, if they retain those dated attitudes. But we have to start with our kids. And we do need to teach boys how to cook. But girls, too. I wouldn't toss the girls out of home ec.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk just a little bit about the organic movement? Because you spend some time in the article about this, talking about today's organic farmers who have operated for the most part without benefit of public investment in research, but have frequently been exceeding conventional yields. Can you talk about why more yields, and if indeed we're going to see a lot more and need to see a lot more organic farming ahead?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things is, you know, we think that the way we grow food conventionally is the most efficient way to do it. But as you look at it, you discover that, one, that's where all the research has gone into pesticides, into how to make monocultures survive, whether you're talking about monocultures of animals or plants, how to keep animals alive in feedlot conditions. That's what we work on. Yet at the same time, you have these organic farmers who had very little support from government, where many of them were self-taught, and they are getting very impressive yields right now, somewhere between 80 and 100% of conventional yields. And in drought years, and we're going to see more drought years, they actually have superior yields because the soil, when it's managed organically, can hold moisture a lot better than conventional, artificially fertilized fields. But I don't think that – so my conviction is that if we put the genius of our land-grant universities and our agricultural researchers to work figuring out other ways to grow food without fossil fuel, and that means really very well-designed polyculture systems, you know, bringing animals back onto farms to close the nutrient cycle so that the animals are fed on the farms and they return their waste to the farms and you have that closed circle and figuring out rotations that allow you to dispense with lots of fossil fuel fertilizer, which also, if you diversify your farm, you're going to end up with growing fresh food that people can actually eat without processing it. We need to work on that. And I don't think organic is the last word. I think I have seen farms that are far superior to organic farms in their diversity and their ability to survive without any inputs whatsoever. So I don't think we should stop there. I think the organic farmers give us one model, but some of them, too, are falling into monocultures. You know, look, we have organic feedlots now, organic farmers growing all one thing, and that's not what we need. And some organic farms are fossil fuel intensive because they till the soil so much to deal with weeds. So I think we need to put our best minds to work devising systems. And one example I look at in the book, in the article, is how it's done was done in Argentina.
Yes.
They have a very interesting rotation. It's an 8-year rotation, 5 years of growing cattle on pasture, and they produce the best beef in the world by most accounts. And then those pastures are tilled, and they do 3 years of grain. And the interesting thing is, because they've had pasture for 5 years, they don't need any fertilizer to grow 3 years of grain. They have enough nitrogen in the soil from the animals and the grasses. And they also don't need herbicides, because the weeds that live in pastures can't survive in tilled land, and vice versa. So, you know, this is not a small, you know, wanky off-the-grid organic solution. This is something being practiced on 10,000 and 15,000 acre farms. There's no reason we couldn't do something like that in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. But even they are changing
unfortunately, with these very high grain prices and the policies of their government, they're ripping up these grasslands and planting soy. Soy to feed feedlot animals in China, which is another whole story of insanity.
Story. Yeah. Thanks, Mary, very much for the call. We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment from Michael Pollan, who is our guest and has written a fascinating article in the New York Times Magazine just this past Sunday that is a really long letter and very interesting letter and important letter to the next president about food policy and how this will be on the plate in addition to many other areas during the next president and what indeed the next president needs to consider. Michael is a Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley and is the author of several books as well, including In Defense of Food and Eaters Manifesto. 800-486-8655 is the number. Thank you, Mary, for the call. We also have an email address that you can use, and that's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now from Michael, and Carol Ann from Wausau is next. Hi, Carol Ann.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Okay. I'm very interested and intrigued with what's being talked about this morning. The first thing that I wanted to make a comment was that the whole idea of the cookbooks and having to go back to the 50s and stuff or later for simpler recipes. Mm-hmm. I'm a diabetic, and one of the things that I've discovered since I've been diabetic is I've picked up quite a few American Diabetic Association cookbooks. One of the things that I've noticed about them is they are very basic. This other thing is they don't lack in flavor or taste at all.
Mm.
Since this has all happened, I buy more fresh. We have a garden here at home. That we use. I just made spaghetti sauce last week. And we use whatever we have that's in the house. And we deal with Share, which is a different program in and of itself. But one of the things we do is I tend to get a lot of fresh vegetables through them, too, including organic. And we use all the stuff in our recipes here at home. So being a diabetic, I'm not suffering for flavor or taste at all. And at the same time, we're getting a better meal on the table and more nutritious in that fact and helping to serve the community. We have a farmer's market here in Wausau that's just super, and so that we can pick up other things that we need there. So there's a lot of different things, and if people think that they're starving or lacking in flavor, there are a lot of cookbooks out there that through diabetic-wise that you can use, and, I mean, you don't suffer with sugar either because there are recipes with sugar in them.
Michael.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you make a very important point. People, you know, one of the things that fast food has done to us is it's spoiled our taste for whole foods. Because they amp up the salt and sugar and fat so much in fast food that, you know, you have a threshold. If you're used to salty food properly salted tastes bland, and same with sweet things. And so one of the things we need to do, I think, is is teach people how to taste again, taste real food. And that, again, is something we need to work on with kids in the schools, and so that they can taste, you know, more subtleties than salt, fat, and sugar.
Thanks for the call. Can you talk a bit, as you do in the article, about the amount of food that is thrown out in this country? It's astronomically high, isn't it?
You know, it really is. At the consumer level, you throw out, the USDA estimates, about 15% of the food you buy. But then you look at the kind of wholesale level and the amount of food thrown out by stores and everything, and you end up, we grow about 4,000 calories per person in this country. You only need about 2,000 to do well. They estimate that about 1,000 calories is essentially lost to waste. So it's a huge amount of food at every level in the food chain. And one of the things I propose in this article is that we have mandatory recycling in municipalities, so that every municipality has to give you the option and give you a bin, if you don't have your own compost pile, to put your compostables, your food waste, in there, as well as your yard waste, and that the municipalities then compost it and make that compost available for free to anyone who wants to use it to grow, including farmers. You know, because we need to deal with the fact that we're losing all this fertility. And I think that's the kind of, you know, farm support program that people would support, that we basically send our waste back to the farms. There are restaurants who do this, and they're to be applauded. And we go to the trouble to sort their food waste and send it back to the farms they're buying food from. But we all need to do this. We need to get our waste back on the land.
Right. Thanks so much for the call. We go to Jody next from Nina. Hi, Jody.
Hi. Hi. I'm a big fan of your writing. It's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
Me and my partner were farmers in Nina. We farm about 70 acres of mixed fruit and vegetables. And I would just like to go back to the point that you made about the fact that we need more farmers. And I couldn't agree with you more. For us, we were definitely self-taught, and we had the flexibility to work for $50 a week and apprentice on small organic farms, which I think for a lot of people just isn't a reality, especially these days. This was about 10 years ago. And I think that there are a lot of people that would like to farm and have the passion, but I think the reality of trying to acquire land and also
make a
living, because just as much as we are farmers, we're also small business owners, and we need to support our family. And I work off the farm just to get the health insurance and supplement the income. But I think that without family land and without renting land, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. And
yeah.
I think that the model of you know, 1 acre plots or smaller plots is definitely part of the picture, but we're in the situation where we're kind of that mid-range, and we're not certified organic. We use IPM methods. It's where we are, and it's what we have, and it's how we can make a living.
Well, you're to be applauded for using IPM. I think it's really an important technology. But it's very hard to enter farming today. The average age of a farmer is 55 in this country. The land near our cities, which is where we need more farms, is too expensive for farmers to buy, and so most farms are on inherited land. And also learning the skills to do the kind of mixed, you know, diversified farming that I'm talking about, that we're not teaching that. So we have to work on this from several different angles. I mean, from the point of view of our land grant colleges, which have to be teaching this sort of agriculture to people. We also need to figure out incentives for people to lease land to farmers, so farmers don't have to buy the land. You know, we've got land trusts popping up all over the country that have done a really good job of preserving open space near our cities. We have to work with the land trust to put farmers on that open space. In many places, you know, they decide they want to save agricultural land because they love the views and the way the landscape looks. And then, lo and behold, the second growth forest comes back, and it's, you know, it no longer looks the way people want it to look. Well, the way you keep it open is you keep farmers on the land. So And I think that I really think that the government needs to look at farm work the way it is now looking at, you know, these green jobs that that Obama says he's going to create with his investment in alternative energy. Farming, sophisticated polyculture farming, is as important as any of these alternative energy jobs that we are going to be creating and supporting. And
it's a green job.
It's the greenest job of all. And so we need the government to support that in the way they're going to be supporting these other jobs, because farms have the potential not only to help us with our public health crisis, but and not only to mitigate greenhouse gases, but actually help with the problem. Because if you farm well, if you rotate properly and don't use synthetic fertilizers, you can actually use farms to sequester huge amounts of carbon. Farms can be part of the solution to climate change, and they should be rewarded for doing that.
We have an email, Marvin in Superior. Great guest. I'm a 32-year-old hobby farmer from Northwest Wisconsin. Grow and raise the majority of food consumed by my 5-person family, as well as provide food for extended family and friends. My kids wish we had chicken nuggets or pizza instead of fresh vegetables, steak, and eggs. What I can't do myself, I trade to others. It's not cheap, but it's very rewarding. Several parts to that. You want to comment?
Well, you know, the kids issue is a real challenge. I mean, kids are, you know, they're bombarded with marketing messages and very tempting fast food. You know, the reason people buy this stuff is it's been engineered to appeal to us and to kids' taste buds in particular. So it's a real challenge for parents to teach their kids how to eat real food. One way to do it is to cook with them. I find with my own child that when he learned how to cook at home and joined us in the kitchen, he learned how to taste, and he developed more interesting taste than the usual fast food. And he doesn't have much taste for fast food anymore. But it was a struggle, there's no question.
Right. Thanks for the call and for the email. Let's go to Dick from Sister Bay next. Hi, Dick.
Good morning, Kathleen, and your guest. I just want to make two comments. One is, it's interesting that when you go to a Subway restaurant and you see those buckets of fresh vegetables, so-called fresh vegetables out there, I wonder if any of them are actually locally grown fresh vegetables. I suspect not.
Subway, yeah, I suspect not.
But it would be great if each of us would ask that person serving at least to put a bug in their ear that maybe there's a farmer out there who could supply those tomatoes or carrots that are there.
That's a terrific idea.
Mm-hmm.
The main reason for the call, though, is to plug an organization called the Farm Market Kitchen. And Michael might be aware of others of these around the country, but a smaller community in Wisconsin has, and it's Algoma, Wisconsin, has a Farm Market Kitchen where you as a grower, if you wish, can bring your product in and produce a saleable product with it without having your own commercial kitchen. In other words, this market, this kitchen, provides all that anyone would need to do their own canning as a for a small fee and to allow them to set up their own business. As we've said over the years, gee, if I could just bottle that, I'd make a fortune.
Yeah.
Well, part of our problem is that so much of what people are doing in making their own gardens is a self-sustaining operation. It doesn't really go beyond that. And because of our short growing seasons, we need to expand what we're doing. And for those people that have the bug, that have a little fire in their belly to go the next step, this type of an operation, especially in America's breadbasket here, would really be a great thing to see more than just in one community. But if anyone wants to know more about it, they can get in touch with the folks at the Farm Market Kitchen in Algoma.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael.
It's a terrific idea. I mean, there are a lot of people who would also, you know, would benefit from that. And, you know, a lot of people don't own full sets of pots and pans anymore, let alone pressure cookers and things like that. And there's no reason that it wouldn't make sense to share those facilities and also get some skilled help in learning how to do things like canning. So I think that's, you know, it's very exciting what's going on all over the country, these new ideas, these new old ideas that are popping up everywhere as people rediscover these lost arts. I'm very encouraged by what I see happening across the country.
You know, that made me think pots and pans. My mother, who's been gone for almost 9 years now, but she, I am still cooking with the pots and pans that she won from the A&P supermarket back in the 50s of why I like to shop at A&P in 50 words or less. And I'm thinking about this, wondering what she used to shop for 50 years ago. I bet it was a little different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Dick, very much for the call. We're plumb out of time. Michael, thank you so much. It's such a superb article you've written. It just covers so much territory so thoroughly. I really admire what you do. It's great.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. Thanks for spreading the word. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we're happy to. Michael Pollan is our guest this hour. And the article, if you haven't read it, please do. It's food for thought. And it's in the New York Times Sunday Magazine this past Sunday, just a couple days ago, October 12. It's well worth your read. Michael is a Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley and the author of several books, including In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto. And his article is Letter to the Next President. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, to John Tretter for on-air production. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you. We just don't have enough time for all the interest. But we'll talk about this topic again. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.